From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Big news on the political horizon today. It's expected that both Republican candidate Rudy Giuliani and Democratic candidate John Edwards will announce they're pulling out of the presidential races. We'll talk with our political analyst in a few minutes, but for now, John McCain has taken one step closer in the race to the White House. He won Florida's Republican primary yesterday with 36% of the vote. Hillary Clinton got the Democratic nod, but hey, none of the delegates officially count. So how does this increasingly smaller pack of candidates keep their chances at victory alive? For more on the Florida primary, we've got Ron Elving. He's NPR senior Washington editor. Hey, Ron.
Hello, Farai.
So it's been busy. What can you say? I mean, a lot of news emerging since last night. Take a minute to update us on what the big headlines are.
Okay, it's still the big headline that John McCain won Florida. It was a good-sized turnout. It was Republicans only. He won. He won clearly. It was a terrible blow to Mitt Romney. And that was also even more true for Rudy Giuliani, who had pretty much shoved all his chips onto Florida. He finished a poor third. He's dropping out today. Now, on the Democratic side, as you said, Hillary Rodham Clinton got a big vote. She got 50% of the overall vote. It was a very heavy vote on the Democratic side as well. She got more votes than John McCain, and yet she gets no delegates for it because the Democratic primary in Florida had been pretty much outlawed by the Democratic National Committee. So no delegates being awarded yesterday, and none of the candidates had campaigned there, although Hillary did fly in last night to bask in the warmth of the straw vote, essentially, that they took there.
Now, Rudy Giuliani obviously has seen the deck of cards. What about Mitt Romney? Where does he stand right now?
Mitt's going to have to make a tough decision because basically all the candidates are out of money and have to go back out and try to raise more money on the Republican side. I think the Democrats, Obama and Hillary, still have a fair amount of money to spend that they had already raised. But the Republicans have pretty much all maxed themselves down. So Rudy doesn't really have Mitt Romney doesn't really have a chance to go back to that many fundraisers at this point. He's pretty much going to have to dig into his own pockets. He's already done that for tens of millions of dollars. He's going to have to decide, do I dip into my own pocket for tens of millions of dollars to try to win California, New York, New Jersey, Illinois, the big states voting next Tuesday, or does he try to be the king of the small states?
Now, we're going to talk about the Democratic delegates or lack thereof with our political analyst a little bit later in the show, but the Republican Party was also stripped of half of its delegates. Can you explain a little bit to us about who's making these decisions and how are people reacting? I mean, if at all, do they even know that they're being kind of denuded of political power?
I think a lot of people in Florida don't understand this. They know that their party moved the primary up into January. They liked that because they thought they were going to get more attention from the candidates. And on the Republican side, it clearly worked. They had 57 delegates available, winner take all, and that was the biggest chunk thus far this year in the Republican Party. So all the candidates turned out. It was the no excuses primary. Everybody still in it had to run in Florida, and it was a big momentum builder before next week's Super Tuesday. So it worked out okay for the Republicans, and they got half a loaf. On the Democratic side, because there were no delegates and because all of the candidates signed this no campaign pledge and stayed out of Florida, it really turned into a big bust and a big, confusing, frustrating thing for Florida Democrats.
So let's talk money. How costly has the primary race been so far for both sides? Are there any candidates that are on the brink of running out of money?
I'd say probably all of them on the Republican side are effectively out of money at this point. But John McCain can go out and raise new money. Mitt Romney can spend from his own pocket. He doesn't look like the front runner, so he's not going to be able to raise very much money in the next week before Super Tuesday, but John McCain can. And that's, of course, why Rudy Giuliani's getting out. He doesn't want to get whipped in his home state of New York next week, but he's really tapped out. The Democrats, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, have long-standing ties to people through the internet who can continue to come up with money for them and keep them going. John Edwards, not so much. John Edwards, totally out of money, and that's why in New Orleans today, John Edwards is dropping out.
Well, Ron, thank you so much for the update.
My pleasure, Florai.
We've been speaking with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. He joined us from our studio at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. So the race is tightening, people are picking sides, and are some members of the Congressional Black Caucus caught between competing demands for their support? Barack Obama is, after all, a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, the only senator in the group, but Hillary Clinton has worked for years with caucus members. Before yesterday, 17 members of the Congressional Black Caucus had endorsed Obama, while 15 had given Clinton the nod. Well, yesterday, influential California Representative Maxine Waters finally made her decision.
I have been through a lot in my political career, and I'm looking for concrete proposals. I'm looking for not only concrete proposals, proposals that are well thought through and people who, you know, are credible in being able to implement them. I think that for me, Hillary is a policy wonk, and I am focused on public policy. And I'm thinking about action and thinking about what people say, how they present themselves, and whether or not they sound really credible on hardcore concrete ideas and proposals. And she just emerges as that one for me. I know that I will have access for my constituents. I need to be able to be a good advocate for them with someone who will understand, you know, my concrete proposals and be willing to engage me and talk with me and act on them. And she just emerges as that person for me.
What does it mean to put your hat in someone's ring? Does it mean that you are, for example, trying to lead your constituents, that you're trying to lead other people who are part of the Congressional Black Caucus or part of Congress? What exactly does you putting your chips on the table mean?
For the past 20-something years, I have been putting out a sample ballot. And if people don't get it at the time that they think they should, my office is inundated with calls. You know, through the media, through your sample ballot operation, I let people know what's on my mind. And I try and let them know why I'm doing what I'm doing, and then they make their decision.
Congresswoman, I've had a chance to come to your offices in South Los Angeles, and you have a multiracial coalition of staffers, black, white, Asian,
right.
Latino, Latina. Right. And your district is very mixed. It's
yes.
very much a part of urban Los Angeles and part of the mix of
yes.
native-born people, immigrants, people from different backgrounds.
That's true.
When you think about leading a district like yours, how do you serve people who have such different interests?
Oh, I think it's not so difficult. I think in the final analysis, if people think you're fair and you're open and your decisions and your work is transparent, they respect that. And that's how we try and do it.
Congresswoman, what if Senator Barack Obama becomes president? Let me give you two scenarios. One
yes.
scenario is you go down as someone who was on the wrong side of history.
Uh-huh.
As part of a group of African Americans who could not endorse a black man running for president. Mm-hmm. Scenario two is that's not a big issue, but people in your district feel the pinch because you're not on the inside of the winner's circle. What about those two scenarios?
Well, first of all, let me just say that, you know, when I worked for Jesse Jackson in 1984 and 1988, there were many people who did not support him. And people started out being divided in terms of you supported Jesse, you didn't. And people got over it and they went on and, you know, lived their lives with all of the complicated decisions that people have to make. When you take a look at elected officials and what they do, you will find you have African-American elected officials who have not supported other African-Americans. And I think if you look at Obama, you'll find the same thing. You know, people make their decisions, they stand with them, and they get over it. And then you have people who are running now, didn't support a Jesse Jackson. They had the opportunity to, and I don't know where they were at the time, but I don't think anybody holds them responsible for not having done that. I just don't think it works that way.
Well, this is one of those points at which people make decisions about how to lead. People who are leaders like yourself can either say, I'm here to represent the people, and what that means is that I speak their voice, or I'm here to represent the people, which is that I make decisions in their favor.
You describe the diversity of my constituents better than most people and understand that district. And so certainly I can't say that I operate in ways that I know exactly what they're thinking and I'm representing them. I think that we are elected to provide leadership. And I think in doing that, you listen as much as you can. You take into consideration the information that you get. You evaluate from your vantage point in ways that people may not be able to see behind the scenes. And you take all of that information, you put it together, and you make a decision.
Well, you have so many different roles that you play. Are you going to hit the campaign trail and try to do some campaign stumping for Senator Clinton?
Yes. Well, I'll do as much as I can. As you know, as a member of Congress, we are here in Washington voting usually Mondays through Thursdays, so you don't get a chance to do a lot of stumping. But I will. I'll do some, sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Congresswoman, I want to thank you for sharing your time with us.
You're certainly welcome.
That was Representative Maxine Waters. Yesterday, she endorsed Senator Hillary Clinton for president. You can find out more about how members of the Congressional Black Caucus have lined up in the presidential race on our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's been reported that Senator John Edwards has dropped out of the race for the presidency. To read the tea leaves, we've got Donna Brazil. She's a nationally syndicated columnist who also teaches at Georgetown University, plus Robert Trainum, D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. Hi, folks.
Hi. Hello. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. This is a lot popping off right here.
I know. What a wonderful day in American politics.
I can't say that, you know, it's just there's, you know, this is the moment when things seem to crystallize. So let me batter up on this one. Last week I interviewed John Edwards on the show. He had this to say about his campaign.
Oh, I'm in this for the long haul.
Are you running out of money?
No, we actually, here's the amazing thing that's happened. In the last, since the 1st of January, we've raised record amounts online, on the internet. And as a result, the money won't be the issue. We have plenty of money.
Donna, was that a lie, a fib, a desperate hope? What was going on in our conversation?
Well, John Edwards did manage to raise about $3 million over the last couple of weeks. But the truth is, he couldn't break out. He could not break out of the strategic position he was being placed in as coming in third place in every race since the Iowa caucuses. He was falling behind in the national polls, falling behind in statewide polls, and it's very difficult to keep your campaign going when you're not accruing delegates, when you're not able to raise the money. And while John Edwards was someone who inspired a lot of people to talk about health care, the economy, global warming, the truth is that without resources, without momentum, without winning, it's tough to keep a campaign going down the trail.
Robert, do you expect that there will be an endorsement that comes out of the Edwards camp, and if so, for whom?
Yes, I do expect an endorsement. It probably will not happen anytime soon, though. I did speak with the Edwards campaign earlier this morning, and they have stressed to me and others, obviously, that Senator Edwards feels very strongly about running for president. He spoke with Senators Clinton and Obama last night and said that I'm dropping out of this race. However, the fight continues. I need you to pledge to me, this is John Edwards speaking here, that you will continue to talk about poverty, that you will continue to talk about the working middle class, that you will continue to talk about those who are living from paycheck to paycheck. He recognizes that he's still relevant in this campaign, although he's stepping out for I. So he probably will hold his fire, if you will, and wait until after Super Tuesday to see if, in fact, if anyone emerges as the front runner on the Democratic side, and then he will probably make an announcement then.
Donna, it takes a strong woman or man to sit in the driver's seat. It also sometimes takes a strong person to sit in the passenger side and read the map. So do you think that John Edwards could come back as a second-time VP candidate?
Oh, no question. I think John Edwards would make a wonderful VP candidate again if he decides to get back in the political fray. Look, John Edwards, I believe, contributed greatly to this national dialogue, whether it was making poverty an issue in his campaign. Edwards decided to not only launch his campaign in the great city of New Orleans, he's ending his campaign, and following his remarks on ending his race, he intends to go and help rebuild some homes in the historic the Ninth Ward. So John Edwards was a champion for the middle class. He was a champion for the poor. And any serious Democratic nominee would want to give John Edwards consideration on a short list.
Farai, can I speak to that for a
Please
second?
Please do.
You know, Senator Edwards, unfortunately, is experiencing the glass ceiling syndrome, where, candidly speaking, that you have Senators Obama and Clinton kind of having all of the spotlight, if you will. In fact, I recall Senator Edwards routinely raising his hand during the debates and saying, look, I'm here, I'm relevant, please listen to me. What's going to be very interesting in the next couple of weeks is where Senator Edwards' votes go. Do they go to Senator Obama or do they go to Senator Clinton? Senator Edwards tried the class warfare message, if you will, as what Don and I spoke about a few moments ago about championing for the working class. And for whatever reason, although it resonated with a certain segment of the population, it didn't break that glass ceiling so that he can go to the next level. And he recognized that. So it'd be very interesting to see if, in fact, Senator Obama or Clinton pick up on that message. And also, just as importantly, where do those votes go now that he's dropping out?
Robert, let me go ahead, Donna.
Of championing the middle class, on strengthening the economy, on campaigning hard against the corporate interests that dominate Washington, D.C., putting profits before the needs of regular Americans. I think looking ahead, beyond Super Tuesday, where John Edwards might decide to endorse someone, it's clear that with the strong support that he has among labor, organized labor, the Carpenters Union, the Steelworkers Union, those unions will play a very important role, and Robert knows this, in Pennsylvania and Ohio and other states that will still perhaps be decisive in determining who the nominee is on the Democratic side. But I want to salute John Edwards for, starting his campaign, ending the campaign in New Orleans, and making poverty one of the central pillars of his race.
Robert, let's move on to the Republicans. Rudy Giuliani, who could he throw his support behind?
Mayor Giuliani has said that if he was not running for president, he would cheerfully campaign for John McCain. Philosophically speaking, they are on the same page on a lot of issues. They're both personal friends. And it looks like Senator McCain is going to enjoy the benefits of Rudy Giuliani getting out of the race. And it looks like Mayor Giuliani probably will endorse Senator McCain, if not later on today, probably later on in the week.
Now, Donna, how did you parse out the maneuvering on the Republican side? They have seen, Senator Thompson drop out and Mitt Romney. Break it down for me this way. Mike Huckabee has been seen as the social conservative. Mitt Romney has been seen by some people, but not all people, as the fiscal conservative. What's John McCain?
John McCain is a moderate conservative. I think he's center right, more center, because of his tendency to be American and speak up about issues that he cares about. I think going forward, John McCain will have to rally conservatives of every stripe to his side to ensure that he has not just enough votes to win the Republican nomination, but also to help unify the country long term.
Yes,
go ahead. No, please go ahead.
Farai, it's very interesting. I sat down with Senator McCain for a 101 about a month ago, and I asked him specifically, do you consider yourself to be a conservative? And as we all know, Senator McCain has a reputation for being a bit feisty and have a bit of a temper. And he was very polite, although you could tell he was very angry by the question, because his answer was, I am a conservative. I'm a Reagan conservative. I have an 85% conservative lifetime rating from, and he listed all of these organizations on the right. And he also said that I am going to win this nomination because I'm a red-blooded conservative. But interesting enough, he does not have that perception. He has the perception of being a maverick. He has the perception of being someone that is a little bit right-to-center on many issues, whether it be fiscal issues or some other things. And interesting enough, the real question is whether or not Mayor Giuliani's endorsement and Joe Lieberman's endorsement, the independent senator from Connecticut who was Al Gore's running mate in 2000, will that help him with social conservatives? Is this just yet another example of how John McCain is maybe a conservative, but he's perceived as a moderate. So it's going to be very interesting to see.
Let me ask each of you this. I'm going to start out with you, Robert, since you just gave us a little overview. What distinctions can people make in this race on the Republican side? What issues, if any, separate Huckabee, McCain, and Romney, who seem to be vying for the top spot?
Right now, on the Republican side, there is a civil war going on as to who is the right standard bearer, if you will, for Ronald Reagan's legacy. There are some people out there that believe that none of the Republican candidates right now, except for Huckabee, is an ideologue, is a movement conservative for I, that's really going to fight the fight when it comes to the Supreme Court nominations, when it comes to pro-life issues, when it comes to stem cell issues. And there's another side that says, well, wait a minute here. We're a big tent party. We should be about broad issues, i.e., a stronger defense and lower taxes. And that's where the John McCain kind of Rudy Giuliani, at least perceptually, fit into. And the movement conservatives are saying, well, that's the reason why we like Mike Huckabee. Remember, Mike Huckabee won Iowa by 61% when it came to ideologues, because they said, they meaning ideologues, said, this is a person that we know that's going to fight for the issues that pertain to us. The reason why he lost New Hampshire is because ideologues on the conservative side do not exist in New Hampshire. So it's going to be very interesting to see if, in fact, who emerges, if you will, as the Republican nominee. It appears that it's going to be like 1996 all over again, where the social conservatives are saying, you know what, Bob Dole, we're going to nominate you as the nominee of our party. We're not happy about it, and we're going to do everything we can to get you elected, but we're not overly happy about it.
Don, I'm going to flip this for you on the Democratic side. You obviously spent a lot of time on air at CNN, and on the night of the State of the Union, Senator Obama was on CNN and asked about the distinctions between him and other people in the race on the Democratic side, and he said, pretty frankly, well, you know, there's a lot of consensus, meaning, you know, honestly, there's not that much difference in what we're pledging to do. Is it a question of what people are pledging to do on the Democratic side, or a question of how they're going to go about doing it? How do people make decisions who are voters, based on positions or based on whether or not you think people are going to fulfill their promises?
Well, there's no question in every presidential election, people look at the characteristics of the individual candidates as well as the issues that they try up on the campaign trail. But I think this year people are looking beyond just personal qualities and the issues, because Democrats are so close together on these issues. They are looking at Washington. Who can get the job done? Who not only has the experience, but who could bring about the change? This is a real fierce debate that's taking place in the Democratic Party, and it's a good debate, and we need to have it at this hour.
Now, as we wrap up, just a quick hit of international news. The Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, is calling for peace in Kenya, asking national leaders to end the political warfare. Yesterday, we had an extensive report on the hundreds of thousands of people displaced by political violence. Is the administration going to step in, and really put some muscle, Donna, behind trying to deal with the issues in Kenya?
Well, Condoleezza Rice, she is preoccupied by this, as well as the Middle East and other issues that are on her plate. She wants to get it right. She wants to ensure that the opposition has a voice in the government. She knows that this Kenya, which is a democracy, things are unraveling. Kenya has been an ally in the war on terror. So this is on her agenda, on her plate, and we should all pay attention to what's going on over there.
Ron?
Well, there's no.
I'm sorry, Robert.
That's okay. There's no question about it that Secretary Rice feels very deeply in her heart of hearts that this is the right thing to do. In other words, to use United States military might and diplomatic might to try to mediate this process. Donna is absolutely correct. This administration has a full plate right now. When it comes to economic issues, we obviously are struggling here at home, obviously over in the Middle East, and you just name it, whether it's Iraq, Iran, whether it be Palestinian or whether it be Israel. There's a lot going on right now. Unfortunately, Kenya is probably at the low end of the totem pole when it comes to priorities right now.
When you look, Robert, at this administration, is there going to be an international legacy? This is the final year of the Bush administration. Condoleezza Rice has obviously gotten both applause and boos at different times from different people. Is this going to be something where there is a mark left in a footprint of history by the Bush administration internationally?
Well, you know, the Bush administration really wants their mark to be made on two things internationally, faith-based initiatives globally, as well as obviously here in the United States, but also on global AIDS. The president feels very, very strongly about trying to push back, if you will, the global spread of AIDS. He views this as a national security issue, as a homeland security issue, and obviously as a health issue. He really wants, I asked him about this actually a couple of weeks ago, he wants it to be known that the Bush administration tripled AIDS funding globally. Now that's true. There's no question about it that no other president, including Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton and his father, George H.W. Bush, even put AIDS, global AIDS, on the map. But the real question is will Iraq and some other things overshadow that? And only time will tell.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Again, thank Robert, you. Donna, thank you.
Thank you.
Donna Brazile is a nationally syndicated columnist who also teaches at Georgetown University, and she joined us from Washington, D.C. Robert Trainum is the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. He also joined us from Washington. Okay, here's a big question. How powerful are political endorsements? Answer, in part, why not check on the web? What do we mean? Well, Jeffrey Bennett knows the score, and he's our web producer here at News & Notes. Hey, Jeff.
What's up, Fred?
Well, as you can tell, things are starting to crystallize and solidify in terms of this race. So you've got this endorsement of Barack Obama by Senator Ted Kennedy and his niece, Caroline Kennedy. How's that reverberating online?
Well, it's interesting. After Caroline Kennedy's op-ed appeared in the New York Times, searches of her name rose 179%, mainly by people over the age of 35 and across two-thirds of the nation geographically. Now, this is according to Yahoo Buzz Index. Now, as for Ted Kennedy, his searches went up 248%. And people were also searching for more about JFK, Maria Shriver, and Jacqueline Kennedy. So the question is, what does it mean for Obama? Well, after this endorsement, people went online to check out his other endorsements. They were searching for information about his religion and for more info about his wife. But Yahoo's overall search analysis suggests that his endorsement, Kennedy's endorsement, might have rekindled more interest in the Kennedy legacy and less driving support for Obama's campaign.
Now, what about the bloggers who are, you know, in our camp? What story are they hitting?
Well, on the Democratic side, among bloggers, the website BlogPulse, which measures these trends, posts about Hillary Clinton outnumbered blog posts about Barack Obama leading up to last weekend's South Carolina primary. And interestingly, on January 24th, 2 days before the voting started in South Carolina, posts about Bill Clinton spiked, and they equaled the numbers of posts about Barack Obama. But after he won South Carolina, posts about Obama spiked, and he's been the most blogged about candidate ever since. And on the Republican side, John McCain has been and is the most blogged about candidate.
What about on News and Views, our own blog?
Well, lots of issues people are talking about, and they run the spectrum. They're talking about Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick's text message scandal, suggesting an affair with his female chief of staff, which could lead to perjury charges. We called it textual healing on our blog. Bill M. wrote about it, Kilpatrick stays in the news, proving all the naysayers right with his childish antics and questionable judgment. He should resign. And there's also the news that Broadway's The Color Purple is closing next month due to slow ticket sales, and some people said it was because the singer Fantasia left the show without any thunder after she left.
All right. Just briefly, what do you think about the newsletter? What does that offer people that everything else we do doesn't? We've got the radio show and the blog, but, you know, you put out this great newsletter every day. What's going on with that?
Well, we've got headlines that pertain to African Americans. We have highlights from the show. And the difference is it's called push media. It's a 90s internet buzzword. And the idea is that you get all these things that you want sent to your inbox every day without having to surf from website to website. And it's a service that we offer.
All right. Well, I hope people check it out. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me in our studios at NPR West. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News & Notes. Our bevy of bloggers takes on politics and more. Specifically, what did Jesse Jackson say about the next generation of young black politicians, and what would Jesus do about BET? With us, we've got Gina McCauley. Her blog is called What About Our Daughters? And Dwayne Brayboy writes the blog Black Informant. Hey, folks.
Hey. Hey, Farai. Happy New Year.
Yes, thank you. How you doing?
I'm great.
So earlier in the show, we heard from California Congresswoman Maxine Waters, and she endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. So black Congress people have been split over who to endorse. Gina, you first. Were you surprised by Maxine Waters' endorsement?
Actually, I'm not. My impression is that the African-American women in the caucus, at least publicly, the ones who've been most vocal, have come out in favor of Hillary Clinton. In fact, I think most of the Hillary Clinton supporters in the caucus have been quite vocal with their support. So I wasn't surprised that she came out. And I brought this up, and this is something that I've talked about on the blog and on the Afrosphere Google group, is questioning whether or not Senator Barack Obama did enough to amass support within the traditional African-American political establishment before he ran, because Hillary Clinton, I think the difference between them that I've said before is that Hillary Clinton has allies and Barack Obama has fans. And mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton's allies will go out there. Not only will they fight for her, they will fight instead of her because their political lives, I think, in their minds are tied to hers. And so you will see the fervor that John Lewis and Charlie Rangel and some of the other CBC members have come out with in defense of Hillary Clinton, that to a certain extent, Barack Obama doesn't have the same depth on his bench, but in South Carolina, he didn't need it. So,
well, Dwayne, there was one of the bloggers we've had on, Skeptical Brother, wrote this headline: Maxine Waters sells out to Hillary Clinton. Does that assume that endorsing anyone but the black man is a sellout, which is something we've talked a lot about, including on our trip to South Carolina? People say, no, you should decide on the issues, but what people say and what people think are often two different things.
Yeah, I agree. And I think Gina actually hit the nail on the head there. I think, Gina, you had something on your site yesterday saying, name of the website, but, you know, basically they called... What was the woman's name again? I'm
Dr. Maya Angelou.
Called her a hoe because she chose Hillary over Barack. And that's the kind of mindset, unfortunately, that you have out there.
You're talking about one of the people who posted on the blog?
No.
Yes.
There's a popular gossip blog that any African-American who's come out on behalf of Hillary Clinton, from Magic Johnson to Charlie Rangel, anybody, he's labeled them a sellout, and the women have been labeled hoes. And he or they have a series of posts called Ho Sit Down. And yesterday, someone emailed me, and I went to this site, and there is a picture of the 80-something-year-old Maya Angelou. You can see the ravages of the stroke that I think she's had. And over her name is Ho Sit Down. And there are probably 1,000 comments. People are very angry. I have a post on What About Our Daughters about it. You can see a screen capture of it. And on What About Our Daughters, back in November, I started to address this whole idea that a vote for Barack Obama is somehow an indication of racial loyalty. My argument has always been that African Americans should be able to vote for whoever they think is in their best interest without it being an indication of their racial loyalty, and the idea that the loyalty of African American women, who are raising almost 70% of African American children alone, that their loyalty would be questioned, is ridiculous. And we ought to be able to disagree without people being labeled sellouts. But it's gotten ridiculous online for them to label Dr. Maya Angelou a hoe. Because she came out in support of Hillary Clinton. It blows my mind. You could go read the post and post about it on What About Our Daughters and contact the sponsors who are appearing side by side with this picture of the 80-something-year-old Maya Angelou being labeled a hoe because she endorsed Hillary Clinton.
All right, Gina, I want to make sure we touch on a topic that you know a lot about. You spoke with Jesse Jackson exclusively for Essence.com. Where were you guys physically in the world, and what did you talk about?
Oh, my goodness. I thought they said he was in Indiana. Jesse Jackson was in New Delhi, India, for the 60th anniversary of the assassination of Gandhi. And I was here in Austin, and we were connected through his scheduler. And we talked about a lot of stuff. You can read on Essence.com. It's a pretty, I think, lengthy by magazine standards interview. But we talked about his current passion, which is subprime lending, student loans, We talked a lot about that, but I mainly wanted his view on the South Carolina race. So we talked about what the numbers meant as far as potential looking down the road in November. But I asked him a lot of the questions that we as Black bloggers have been discussing amongst ourselves, or actually brawling amongst ourselves about for the past 3 or 4 months. One of the big things that a lot of Black bloggers have said, a lot of Barack Obama supporters have said, is that they absolutely will not vote for Hillary Clinton because of the way that the Clinton machine has, in their opinion, treated the Obama campaign. And I asked him that question, and he didn't even pause when he responded. He was like, well, then I guess they're gonna end up with some white wing Republicans in the White House that are gonna stack the Supreme Court. One of the things that impressed me about Reverend Jackson is that questions that I've had like for months that commenters and bloggers could not answer, would not answer, he was able to provide the answer without pausing, and a lengthy, in-depth answer. And a lot of people have emailed me saying, we didn't know he was so intelligent and thoughtful. And I was like, yeah, he is.
Well, Gina, I'm going to have to move on. We got one last topic, very little time. I'm going to go to you first, Dwayne. In November, we talked about the Enough is Enough campaign, about the protesters going out to the home of the CEO of Black Entertainment Television, BET. Now, there's another wrinkle, how Black preachers stack up. Gina's blog has been vocal about this campaign. And do you think that Black preachers who have now written a letter of support about BET, some of them, are out of line?
I guess I'm really mixed about this. This is something I've written about quite extensively on my site as well. And I take a different approach to that. And I'm like this pretty much. If you don't like the program, then turn to something that you like. You know, I've been in several conversations with people who regularly bash BET, and most of them can't even tell me what exactly is on BET. They still have the mindset that BET is 90% or 100% booty shaking videos when it's actually only 20%. Now, the bottom line is this. I think this is my opinion. I think that the whole anti-BET movement is very elitist. And the reason why I say that is because the anti-BET movement is no more represents all of Black America than BET. Now, why do I say this? Because, like it or not, there is a demographic out there of Black folks that do watch the videos in question on a regular basis. Now, in short, if you're basically what you're doing is that you're shoving your taste down their throats. In this movement,
I'm going to have to interrupt you just to give Gina a little teeny, and Gina, teeny taste. You think this is whack? Question mark.
I think it's. The only reason that these clergy were contacted by BET is to counteract the direct action by a minister in Maryland who's been giving them a hard time for a few months. And also, there's a problem with BET sponsoring a religious conference that these ministers who have signed this letter. And so you could go to What About Our Daughters. The whole thing is about to blow up, and you could read the history of it. But I think it's inappropriate for them to play a part in an orchestrated campaign by Viacom to give the impression that men and women of faith are divided on the issue of BET. That's
all
the
right.
Only reason. Yeah.
We have to wrap it up there. I want to thank you both, Gina McCauley of What About Our Daughters from KUT in Austin, Texas, and Dwayne Brayboy of Black Informant at KUCI in Irvine, California. Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn was published in the U.S. in 1885. The story follows a poor white teen named Huck and Jim, the runaway slave he joins forces with. The book became one of the most controversial classics of American literature, mostly because of lines like these, which contain a racial epithet.
We went tiptoeing along a path amongst the trees back towards the end of the widow's garden, stooping down so as the branches wouldn't scrape our heads. When we was passing by the kitchen, I fell over a root and made a noise. We scrouched down and laid still. Miss Watson's big nigger named Jim was sitting in the kitchen door. We could see him pretty clear because there was a light behind him. He got up and stretched his neck out in about a minute, listening. Then he says, "Who dat?"
Today, as part of NPR's series In Character, a look at the fictional American characters that impact our lives, we take a closer look at Jim. Was Jim a stereotype or heroic? The fact that that debate continues today reflects the book's bold approach to race, class, and the use of vernacular speech. We're going to hear more of that speech, this time an exchange between Jim, played by actor Voltaire Sterling, and Huck, played by actor Daniel Gray. Huck and Jim are both on the run for different reasons. Here they discuss why they both ended up hiding on the same island. A warning to our listeners, we'll be hearing dialogue and language taken directly from the book, including racial epithets.
How'd you come to be here, Jim? And how'd you get here?
Maybe I better not tell.
Why, Jim?
Well, there's reasons. But you wouldn't tell on me if I was to tell you, would you, Huck?
Blamed if I would, Jim.
Well, I believe you, Huck. Huck, I run off.
Jim!
But mine, you said you wouldn't tell. You know you said you wouldn't tell, Huck.
Well, I did. I said I wouldn't, and I'll stick to it. Honest Injun, I will. People would call me a low-down abolitionist and despise me for keeping mum, but that don't make no difference. I ain't gonna tell, and I ain't going back there anyways. So now let's know all about it.
Well, see, it is this way. Old Mrs., that's Miss Watson, she pecks on me all the time and treats me pretty rough. But she always says she wouldn't sell me down to Orleans. But I noticed there was a nigger trade around the place considerable lately, and I began to get uneasy. But one night I creeps to the door pretty late, and the door wasn't quite shut. Now here old Mrs. Tittle with her, she gone sell me down to Orleans. Well, she didn't want to, but she could get $800 for me. And it is such a big stack of money she couldn't resist. The widow, she tried to get her to say she wouldn't do it, but I never waited to hear the rest. I lit out mighty quick, I tell you.
Is this the voice of a hero?
I think in many ways Jim is the hero of Huck Finn.
Dr. Shelley Fisher Fishkin is Director of American Studies and Professor of English at Stanford University.
It is the voice of a very compelling, appealing, and complicated character for whom Twain had enormous admiration and who he wants the reader to admire. He is mature, sensitive, sharp, self-aware. What he's not aware of is how completely screwed up the society is that is imposing all this on him. In other words, no character in the book questions the system that places the most admirable man in the book at the same level as his mistress's pigs and chickens.
The Civil War, you had more than 600,000 Americans who lost their lives in the battle between North and South, and slavery wasn't the only issue, but it was the crux of how we see it today, as well as one of the huge issues then. But Huck Finn was published 20 years after both the war and slavery ended. So set a scene for us. What was America like at the time that this book was published?
Twain starts the book in 1876. He finishes it in 1883. And this is a very, very depressing and grim and rather shocking period in American history when almost all of the gains that African Americans made right after the Civil War are being overturned. So what you're finding is that this is a period when African Americans in the South are in effect being re-enslaved, not unlike what happens to Jim, who has been running for freedom during the book and then is reincarcerated on the Phelps farm. Twain is not writing a book that is attacking slavery. Slavery has been gone. But he's writing a book that engages the racism that persisted after slavery ended and that still persists in American society. And this is one of the reasons why the book is so complicated and so interesting.
Students across America do read Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, but it's also been banned particularly for uses of the word nigger. Was that common speech at the time, or a slur, or both?
It was both at the time. It was common speech in much of the South, particularly, and it was also a slur at the time that was increasingly recognized as such. If you read writing from the same period as Twain wrote, by others, you'll find the word nigger used throughout a lot of stories and novels, pieces written by Black writers as well as white writers, also in poems. But, you know, it can be used in contexts that are just uncritically accepting the word as what was used, or it can be used in contexts in which people are using that word in full knowledge of the slur that it embodied and using it to subvert the thinking behind that.
Let's go back to the book. This time, Jim and Tom Sawyer. In this excerpt, Jim has been captured. He and Tom are discussing some unusual strategies to set Jim free.
You got any spotters in here, Jim?
No, sir. Thanks to goodness I ain't, Master Tom.
All right. We'll get you some.
But bless you, I don't want none. I was afraid of them. I just soon have rattlesnakes around.
It's a good idea. Where could you keep it?
The goodness gracious alive, Master Tom.
Why, if there was a rattlesnake to come in here, I'd take him bust right out through that log wall, I would, with my head.
Jim, don't act so foolish. A prisoner's got to have some kind of a dumb pet. And if a rattlesnake ain't ever been tried, why, there's more glory to be gained in your being the first to ever try it than any other way you could ever think of to save your life.
Mas Tom, I was willing to tackle most anything that ain't unreasonable. But if you and Hook Fitch was a rattlesnake in here for me to tame, I was gonna leave, that's sure.
Now, Dr. Fishkin, to many of us now in the modern era, that sounds like pure shucking and jiving. So what exactly is going on in this part of the book?
What's tricky is that it probably sounds that way to readers during Twain's day. But we can also look at it through the perspective of history and realize that all of the crazy things that are inflicted on Jim in that last portion of the book resonate with all of the crazy things that are inflicted on African Americans who want to vote after the Civil War, after the end of Reconstruction, up through the Civil Rights Movement. So, I mean, there's a lot of lunacy in store in the next 100 years. And in a sense, this passage in the book looks ahead to that, looks ahead to all of the absurd obstacles that are going to be thrown in the way of Black freedom.
Dr. Shelley Fisher Fishkin is Director of American Studies and Professor of English at Stanford University. She's published widely on Mark Twain. For our reading, the voice of Jim was played by Voltaire Sterling. The voice of Huck and Tom was played by Daniel Gray. What great American characters inspire you? Nominate your favorites on our in-character blog. We may put your suggestions on the radio. Go to npr.org/in-character. You can also go there to find links to transcripts from the readings as well as audio. That's our show for today, and thanks for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our fabulous newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.